Look, we live in a dangerous world. We govern by leadership or by crisis.
My name is Nina Schick. I'm a sovereign AI strategist. This is Industrial Intelligence. Today, I had the chance to talk to Secretary Panetta, former head of the CIA, former Secretary of Defense, former White House Chief of Staff, one of the most senior people alive who's been talking about China, technology, the state of U.S. national security, someone who sat across the table from Xi Jinping. Here's our conversation where we talk about AI, America's moment, technological capability, and geopolitics. So, Secretary, thank you so much for being here with me today. In 2017, Vladimir Putin said, whoever controls AI is going to rule the world. I certainly was taking notice of when he said that almost a decade ago. I was wondering what your reflections are on this accelerating technology and how it pertains to national security and the geopolitical order.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. It's both exciting and scary. It's exciting because it obviously is a developing technology that is rapidly expanding. There's a tremendous amount of interest in investing in it. I can remember as a member of the Oracle board that there was this attitude that AI would ultimately be the dominant technology for the future, and that Oracle had to invest in data centers to support it. But at the same time, it's developing so rapidly that what concerns me are the risks that are out there, whether it's transparency, whether it's privacy, whether it's issues related to singularity, and whether or not ultimately it really will be capable of reflecting human intelligence. And to that extent, what I worry about is whether or not there's any coordinated effort to kind of say, you know, we need to look at this and we need to make sure that we're headed in the right direction. And it's the absence of that that is my greatest concern right now.
Do you think that in part, I mean, you had such an interesting and illustrious career, and so many of the through lines of your career are coming to fruition now, the kind of century of competition between China and the United States, how technology plays a key role to that. But do you think the absence of any kind of coordination or stop button in part has to do with this idea that if there are going to be two AI superpowers in the world, it's going to come down to China and the United States? And it's incumbent upon national security and ultimately also the prosperity of the American people that the U.S. gets there first. So what are your reflections on the competition, the pivot to Asia, which, of course, was a big part of your career, and this idea of this race to AGI and superpower status between China and the United States?
Well, there's no question that as director of the CIA, there was a tremendous amount of attention on China and where it was headed. And what kind of competition we'd be involved with, and what kind of investments they were making, and whether or not ultimately they would push ahead of us, because they're much more disciplined about not only investing in something but making sure that it's going to happen. Yeah, I think there is concern about China's ability to just kind of charge ahead and invest not only in AI, but invest in all of the other technologies that are AI-related that can make a tremendous difference in terms of not only what happens in intelligence, but what happens in business as well. I often say, and I think it applies here, I often say that in a democracy, we govern by leadership or by crisis. And if leadership is there and willing to take the risks associated with leadership, I think we can avoid crisis. But if that leadership isn't there, then I worry that we'll be governed by crisis. And so I guess what I'm asking for is greater leadership by the industry and by government and by those involved in responsible positions, greater leadership to kind of get your arms around this and provide at least a strategy for where we're going to go in the future.
You're one of the most senior leaders alive who's actually met Xi Jinping before his ascendancy over the past decade and a half. What were your reflections on him then, and has that changed in the interim?
Well, it was a very interesting experience because
right.
I had the chance to meet him before he became head of China. But then I met with him when he was head of China. And also I had the opportunity to have a number of discussions with him, both here and in Beijing. And the one thing that I found from the beginning is that normally when you're meeting with a foreign leader, particularly in China, there's a tendency to work from talking points. You have your talking points that you want to get across. China usually has its talking points. And there's this kind of very stiff exchange where you go through the talking points, the interpreters interpret the talking points, and it's very stiff, and it really isn't a conversation. And when I met with President Xi, the first thing that happened is he really didn't follow any talking points.
You weren't expecting.
No, I frankly did not expect that was going to be the case. We were all prepared with our notes. But he wanted to have a conversation. And he immediately proceeded into that conversation in a very bold and direct way. I mean, he began by being very concerned about what the United States was doing at that point, which was basically repositioning our military to the Pacific. And he was concerned about that and thought that that was overly aggressive in terms of the United States. And he was very critical about what that represented for the future. And I responded by saying, look, the United States is a Pacific power, just like China is a Pacific power, and will remain a Pacific power. And the key, it seems to me, is to try to determine where are those areas where we can work together, whether it's dealing with North Korea and the threat from North Korea, or whether it's dealing with trade, or whether it's dealing with security in Southeast Asia or the South China Sea. Where is it that we could work together? And he said something I've never forgotten. He said, you know, if we could do that, if both of our countries could do that, we really could find peace and prosperity. Those were his words, peace and prosperity. I think that at the same time that I have fond memories of that discussion, that I worry that what has happened in China is that he is really, he's struggling to try to protect his position and to make clear that that he has to be the singular leader of China. And in that process, I just get the sense that there are growing concerns about loyalty. There's growing concerns about experience and competence. And there's kind of a paranoia that I think creates a situation that becomes a lot more unpredictable in terms of the future.
So when he said he was interested in there's a potential outcome for peace and prosperity, do you think he meant that, or do you think that it was inevitable that there would always be this kind of standoff, this Thucydides trap between the United States and China? Or do you think that is now a result of this increasing paranoia he feels in his position?
I think at that time, when we had that discussion, I really felt he was interested in having a dialogue with the United States. And it was reflected in policies. As director of the CIA, we developed a relationship with our counterparts in China. As Secretary of Defense, I had the opportunity to actually visit their Navy yards and go on their ships, and we agreed that we would have exercises together, naval exercises together. And it was a good relationship to the extent that we were both able to speak pretty directly to each other, and also indicate that there were areas where we could very well work together in order to be able to deal with whether it's AI, whether it's cyber, whether it's other technologies that are being developed, that it would be far better if we had that kind of relationship where we could actually partner on that. And so I really felt we had made progress. I really felt there was an ability to have a dialogue. And I thought we were in a good place. That's changed a lot. And that change raises a lot of concerns, because if this is a competition, and it is a competition, it's always been a competition, but if it's a competition that doesn't have the ability to have dialogue, to have a conversation, to be able to talk freely with one another about how we should deal with challenges in the future, if we don't have that, then I think what happens is both countries are going to develop a real concern about what the other is up to. And that creates in itself a potential conflict for the future.
And we're arguably knocking on that door right now. In the context of this competition, and I see a through line with cyber, the advanced kind of industries of the future, and AI as kind of, you know, the software, the capability that's going to imbue all of the industries of the future, but also power these cyber capabilities.
Sure.
It seems that if you think about this in the context of this competition, that one of the biggest strategic blunders we made here in the United States and also in Europe was the outshoring of the industrial base, the outshoring and offshoring of all the supply chains that are now so critical. You mentioned your board seat at Oracle, you know, the building of these intelligence factories, and it turns out that, you know, if all our supply chains are not only offshored, but we can't actually build anymore, that's going to be the fundamental crisis. You talked about crisis and leadership. That's the first and foremost crisis I see right now. What are your reflections on the offshoring of everything in the name of globalization? And is this a crisis?
Well, you know, I saw that in particular as Secretary of Defense, because, you know, the reality was that we knew we had to maintain our military as the number one military in the world. And yet the concern was that to build the ships, to build the weapons, to build the tanks, to build the support system you need, that, frankly, we did not have a strong defense industry. We were basically contracting the stuff out to wherever we could get it. And I think the failure was to recognize that we could do both. We could do both.
Yeah.
That clearly we needed to have strong defense industries in this country that were important to our national security. I mean, we see that now with regards to weapons and drones and missiles that we are not able to keep up with demand. we're not able to keep up with what we're using in a war.
Is it something like we have 8 days, but in a war with China, we need 800 days? Yeah. So you need to get the factories, the production.
Yeah, we're not there. We're not there. And so, you know, I think at the same time, look, I'm a believer that we are in a global world. I'm a believer that this world, whether we like it or not, comes together, whether it's security, whether it's finance, whether it's communication, whether it's technology. The reality is that there's a lot that we ought to be working together with in a global world. And I'd like to frankly believe that we could be better at trade in terms of working with other countries and recognizing that they produce good things that we can use, just like we produce good things that they can use, that we could have that kind of trade relationship. Instead, we've gone to war, particularly with tariff policies, but we've become more isolated, and it's driven other countries, frankly, to look elsewhere as a result of that. I mean, I'm reading now where Canada is basically looking at not at developing ties with the United States. They think we're not trustworthy, and so they're developing ties with other countries. All of that can impact on our security. And that's something that we had better get ahead of rather than behind, because things are moving very rapidly in the 21st century.
But how do you reconcile that view of, you know, a globalized world and integrated supply chains when surely one of the biggest forthcoming national security risks is a world where hardware that's manufactured in possibly an adversary's nation state can become a weapon, right? So, and I like to use the example of how Mossad took out all of Hamas's leadership by penetrating their supply chain and getting into the batteries in the dumb pagers that they were using. You know, surely that could be many times worse if, you know, the United States is flooded with Chinese drones, DJI, which should have been an American company in an alternate universe. You know, the drone technology was actually invented in America. The semiconductor was invented in America through a collaboration with the Pentagon. You know, now, of course, they're all manufactured, majority of in Taiwan. How do you reconcile that kind of globalized world with this very real national security risk of having hardware of a possible assailant, you know, flooding your markets, even for consumer technology?
Yeah. Well, I often put on the hat of a former director of CIA. And when I put on that hat, I ask a lot of questions about what are we taking in, what are we buying, what are we bringing that involves the potential of a security risk.
Right.
For the United States. And I think the United States has to be vigilant. It can't just sit back and simply open the doors. It's got to ask questions.
You were warning about 5G, you know, 15 years ago, of course we've accelerated.
Yeah. You know, yeah. We were looking mm-hmm. at what they were selling. We were looking at all of their different products that were coming in. And asking a question, what intelligence is built in to those products that can compromise us in the future? And it was a relationship that made clear that if we didn't raise a red light and say watch out, that there were companies out there because of price competition. And because of availability, we're going to turn to the Chinese for those products. And China knew that. China knew that in terms of the product that they were producing. And so what it takes is the ability to say, hold on, we've got to protect our security. That comes first. Because in the end, if we compromise that, then we are eroding our strength as a military power. So we have got to ask questions. We've got to implement the checks that are necessary. We've got to have the competence to do that. I mean, that's another concern that I think industry and what's happening with AI is demanding that we have a lot of people who are trained in those kinds of technologies, but I'm not sure how many of those trained people are in fact winding up at the NSA or the CIA or other areas that we need that kind of competence. And so we've got to be ahead of the game. We've got to be on the cutting edge, because if we're not there, then it will not take much to basically overwhelm us in the 21st century. So we've got to build technology. We've got to build discipline. We've also, at the same time, have to be smart enough to be able to develop the markets and the trade that is necessary to maintain our economy as well.
So on those two points, on kind of the kind of defense capability, how, you know, it seems to be declining, just looking at the sheer things like the arsenal of artillery that's required, and how, you know, if we were in a war with China, we'd need 800 days, we only have 8 days worth. That makes seems to be changing. There's this whole new generation of defense companies. I mean, just driving down here yesterday, arrived in San Francisco, drove through, you know, this unbelievably dense area of talent concentration, incredible companies coming down here to Monterey. And it seems like, you know, there's a little bit of a criticism now that defense is becoming, you know, to Silicon
That's
Valley.
Right.
But of
That's
course,
right.
the history of Silicon Valley is intricately tied with the Pentagon and the whole defense. But there are all these new companies coming up that are doing incredible things, that are actually building manufacturing and building exactly to address that gap that you're talking about. So do you feel quite energized by that? Do you feel quite optimistic that American spirit of innovation and almost a revitalization of this historic private-public partnership, that things are moving? I'm based in Texas, so I'm quite close to the industrial build-out of the intelligence factories and the factories. So I sense this new impetus, this new...
I think it is happening. Mm-hmm. It's been a long time in coming.
Yeah.
When I was CIA director, I remember going to Silicon Valley because we knew at that point that we needed to develop better research into technologies for the future, and that if we couldn't do it in Washington, we had to do it in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And so I remember going there and meeting with some of the high-tech people on trying to build that partnership, that relationship. And I think that was ongoing. I can remember talking to some of my successors at the Department of Defense who were actually formalizing relationships in Silicon Valley in terms of trying to get them interested in working on the kind of research that we needed. And now what's happened is that it has literally turned in to a boon.
Yeah.
Because now these companies recognize that if they make the right product, they're going to not only will they be in demand, but they'll be also at the center of protecting our national security.
Absolutely.
It's a twofer. The ability to do something that benefits our national defense and at the same time make money. And I think they all see that opportunity. That's a good thing. That's a good thing. Because I have always felt that we're better off when we have a public-private relationship.
Quite.
And partnership.
As has historically been the case.
That's been very important in war, and it's been very important in peace.
Of course, because all of these technologies, like you say, often have a direct link to economic prosperity. The fact that the internet, the semiconductor, it all started really out of the defense industry. So to that point, I wanted to perhaps bring up one of the most important epochs in history, or moments in history, which you were, of course, at the time, you're director of the CIA. I'm talking about the Osama bin Laden raid. And at the time, perhaps you were using some kind of nascent version of Palantir software. Palantir has now obviously become a program of record in the Pentagon. What are your reflections? I mean, I understand quite clearly, not on kind of the strategy of this current administration, but the parallels with what happened in terms of just the sheer intelligence gathering capability with Osama bin Laden, what we've seen more recently with Maduro, and obviously with the Ayatollah Khamenei.
Well, I can remember when I first went to CIA and met with my predecessor. He said something I've never forgotten. He said, you know, in addition to obviously your intelligence responsibilities, you're going to be a combatant commander.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what are you talking about? Well, what I found out was that we were deeply involved in operations to go after the leadership of Al-Qaeda in Pakistan that required a very competent use of drone technology as well as other technologies that were important to that effort, and that no sooner had I become director of the CIA than I was getting phone calls in the middle of the night that targets had been located and whether or not I would give them the permission to go after those targets. And I realized that we were really at a point where I could see where the future was going, and that we were not just simply, I mean, look, intelligence is about people on the ground. It is about spies. It is about doing all of the basic work that's necessary. But what I realized is that with drone technology and with some of the new technologies that were being developed, that we had the ability to develop not only better intelligence, better surveillance, but also that we would have the capability to do a lot more operationally when it came to going after our enemies. And in many ways, that came together on the bin Laden mission.
Yeah.
I mean, we not only were able to get better intelligence, I remember telling the people at the CIA, don't just tell me you don't have any information. I expect you to come into my office and tell me five new ideas about how you would be able to get the intelligence you need in order to locate bin Laden. And they did that. They did that. And we were able to get good intelligence. We located the couriers for bin Laden.
I've watched all the documentaries, read all the books.
The couriers.
Right.
And put a face to the couriers.
Yeah. Yeah,
and then using drone technologies, did surveillance. That brought us to the compound where bin Laden was located. And we then did surveillance on that compound 24/7 for almost 7 months, trying to determine whether bin Laden was actually there. And when it came to the operation itself, the ability to have special forces on very sophisticated new helicopters mm-hmm. that had capabilities that we had not had before, put them on those helicopters, bring them into Pakistan, have them rappel down, have them breach through the walls, and then ultimately get bin Laden. A lot of that was based on new technologies that we needed to develop in order to be successful.
And that's carrying through now, I think, in terms of, and that's right. Ultimately what you want as a deterrent, right? The
Absolutely.
Capability has to be developed.
Absolutely, and you've got it. Mm-hmm. You have to be smart about it, and you have to have people that are well trained in those technologies, and you have to be able to know when do you implement those new technologies, and when do you not do it because of the potential that you could be compromised.
So in terms of the two recent raids, again, just talking about the intelligence and the ability to track down two of the most presumably well-protected men and to be able to take them out, what doesn't that signal a huge intelligence failure on the sides of China and Russia? Or what would they have taken from that, from those two, you know, regardless of the longer-term strategy, from just the success of those two raids?
Yeah, I think that the message we sent as a result of the bin Laden raid was that the United States was a real leader mm-hmm. in our ability to put that mission together, to bring the expertise together, and then to accomplish the mission. And that's been true on other missions as well, the ability to get it done. And yes, it does reflect that in many ways our adversaries have not kept up and that they're vulnerable. And that's important.
Very important.
Because of our ability then to protect our security.
Because as you well know, in kind of national security circles in China, there's been this long held belief that, you know, the U.S. military capability is declining and almost the ascendancy of Russia's century is inevitable. So perhaps there's been some pause for thought.
Well, that's, I mean, you know, I in many ways, that's why I think China is a very important adversary, because they're not standing still. Mm-hmm. And my concern is that if we are not ahead of the game, if we are not being aggressive in advancing our technology and our capability, they are going to take advantage of that. They're going to move fast.
Of course, as is happening now with AI
Exactly.
Of course, of course.
Exactly. They're doing it with AI.
Of course.
You know, with robotics, with
all the embodied
the computer, you know, the ability.
Batteries, drones.
Everywhere.
EVs.
Everywhere.
Of course.
And they've made clear that that's their goal. That's their goal.
They've been pretty explicit about it.
They've been very explicit about it. And for that reason, I have to tell you that what has to happen in the United States is a recognition that budget-wise, we had better add the resources that are necessary in order to do the research, in order to develop the technology, and in order to stay ahead of the curve. That investment is more important than ever.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more with you. And it seems like, at least, you know, that investment, definitely the floodgates have been opened. I mean, right now we're going through the largest investment ever in history, largely through American capital, American public and private capital, just looking at the intelligence factories that are being built, that intelligence which will eventually be imbued into weapon systems or into robotics or into EVs, you know, just $700 billion this year alone.
So That's right.
So it always strikes me as a very bad idea to bet against, you know, the capability of American innovation. I saw data recently that shows that, you know, this belief that China would outstrip or overtake the United States, if you look at it in terms of GDP, there's actually been a gap opening up in the last few years. You sat on the board of Oracle. Oracle is one of the key companies that's building out this largest ever infrastructure investment in the United States right now for data centers, intelligence factories, which I think is absolutely critical to national security. But at the same time, you're starting to see a bipartisan and organized kind of political resistance to that critical infrastructure, both for American prosperity, but also for our national security. And the two of those are intricately tied. What do you think about that? How do you respond to an AOC or Bernie Sanders saying, you know, we need to put a moratorium on this, given the context of the competition, given what the stakes are? How do you respond to that?
You know, I go back to my basic theme that in a democracy we govern by leadership or crisis. Mm-hmm. And it is critical for us to have that leadership
To explain, we
absolutely have to have that leadership, mm-hmm. whether it's in industry or in government. Mm-hmm. Frankly, the biggest concern I have right now is not with industry, it's not with technology. It's basically with dysfunction in Washington. And when there's an inability of leadership of the president, the leadership in the Congress, to be able to come together and to govern, and to be able to work together, what I'm concerned about is that sends a message to our adversaries that our democracy is not as strong as it should be.
And that's something we see across the rest of the Western world. I mean, I worked for a decade in European politics.
Exactly, but that has to be a wake-up call that we cannot get lazy. We cannot play politics as usual. We have got to learn to govern.
So how do you overcome that complacency? Is it almost the peace dividend? Is it that things have been?
It's what we do at our Panetta Institute is what we're trying to do is to build a new generation of leaders. And we need that. We need to have young people who understand that bigger picture and their role in our democracy and their role, frankly, in technology, their role in the future. We need to have that investment. And what I fear is that we get complacent, as we always do. Our worst weakness as a country.
It's not homicide, it's suicide.
We forget too easily the past.
Yeah.
We forget 9/11.
Yeah.
We forget tragedy. But we also forget the importance of education and the importance of making sure that there is a new generation of leaders that we're developing for the future. And hopefully that new generation of leaders will recognize the weaknesses that we have today and will say, we cannot allow that to happen in our watch.
Absolutely. And thank you for the work that you're doing with the Panetta Institute. Even though the dysfunction is great in D.C., I still feel encouraged, for instance, where I am in Texas, to see the build-out and the money. And, you know, this, in many ways, what's happening, it's bigger than who's going to be the president in 4 years' time.
You know what the best hope in our democracy is? It's not Washington. It's what's happening.
And there's
places
so much
like Texas and California and states throughout this country.
Right. Ohio.
Where there's there isn't the partisanship or the division. There's really a much better partnership going on, and people are really willing to invest and work together in the future. That's really the great strength of America, is that innovation and creativity and willingness to work together. That gives me hope that ultimately our democracy will continue to be very strong in the future.
Well, and that's really, you epitomize that. You are the apotheosis, kind of the manifestation of the American dream. If you look at how your parents emigrated here to the United States, your career, your service. And it's one of the reasons I moved to the United States 2 years ago as well. I mean, I grew up in Nepal in the shadow of the CCP. I lived in Europe. And eventually, for me, having lived in Asia and in Europe, the United States was still the best place to kind of build and have that belief in democracy. So
I never forgot when I used to ask my parents, why did they come all of that distance to come to a strange land? And I never forgot my parents' response. They said, because we really felt we could give our children a better life in this country. That's the American dream. That's the American dream. I've had a chance to live that dream. In many ways, you've had a chance to live that dream. The ability to make sure that we give our children that better life is what is at the heart and soul of our country's dream for a better future.
I think that's exactly what brought us here.
Yep.
So 250 years of America coming up a few weeks from now. What are you hopeful about? If we get this right, how does this look 20 years from now or 30 years from now if we get it wrong?
I think we can take one of two paths. One path is an American renaissance. I think the 21st century could be an American century because of our ability to be innovative, creative, ability to educate our young people to the skills they need for the future, the ability of both parties to work together, and the ability of the United States to be a world leader. I mean, those are important qualities that we need for that future America. Or we could be an American decline. If we allow our divisions and our hatreds and our fears and our inability to kind of work together, if we allow that to prevail, then I think we'll go the way of past empires. So in many ways, my greatest hope is that this dream of an American renaissance is a goal that everyone will embrace because they know that's how we give our kids a better life.
Secretary Panetta, you mentioned the importance of alliances, and I agree with you, and also how quickly technology is changing the realities of the battlefield. Perhaps the best example of that is what's happening in Ukraine, where of course, the resilience of the Ukrainian people, for whom it's existential, but also I see increasingly the kind of American technology stack, whether that's AWS or Palantir's smart system, being decisive to kind of the, even in the last few months, you know, the kind of attrition rate for the Russian army. What do you think about that?
I think that provides a tremendous amount of hope for the future. Look, we live in a dangerous world, whether it's China, whether it's Russia, whether it's Iran, whether it's North Korea, whether it's terrorism. We live in a dangerous world. And the key to dealing with that dangerous world is that the United States and our allies have to work together to improve those technologies that are so critical to security. Ukraine is a great example of that. Ukraine, obviously, its people are courageous, they're brave, they're willing to fight and die for their country. That's really important. But more importantly, despite some of the conflicts between the United States and allies and Russia, et cetera, Ukraine has said, we're going to do this on our own. We're attacked by drones. We're going to show others how you use drones, how you defend against drones. And right now, they're providing that guidance to other countries.
It's incredible, the kind of geopolitical leverage. They've signed agreements with all the Gulf states who are quite happy to launder Russian money.
They're turning that into a real advantage as far as building other strong alliances in the world. Other countries, when they depend on Ukraine in order to protect their security, they're not going to forget Ukraine. They're not going to forget what they're about. And so building that relationship on behalf of better security for the future is, I think, going to be one of the keys to confronting a very dangerous world.
Do you already see the through lines of a new kind of global order, and specifically if this can't be the century of the Pax Americana, the century of Pax Silica, where you see, you already mentioned that United States is a Pacific power. You told that to Xi.
I am a strong believer that, and it comes from World War II, but America for 80 years has been a world leader. We cannot afford not to remain a world leader, which means that we have to work with others, we have to work with our allies, we've got to build alliances, and we've got to be able to show the rest of the world that democracy can work.
Thank you so much, Secretary Panetta. Thank you for your time.
Nice to be with you.